This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and it is September 21st, 2009 in Japan, where I am, but it is the 20th of September back in Hawaii, where I'm joined on the line by Albert Lanier, a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in publications like the Honolulu Weekly, and who has appeared online at sites such as the Corbett Report and MediaMonarchy.com. Albert Lanier, thank you for joining me once again.
Thank you for having me once again. It's always nice to speak to you, James, and nice to be on the Corbett Report.
Absolutely. Well, I understand today that you're wanting to talk about the American way of strife. And what is this topic, and what are you looking at talking at today?
You know, the American way of strife is how I refer to the educational and political systems of the United States. And I think it's important, whether one lives in Canada, whether one lives in Japan, or even whether one lives in the United States, to get more of an accurate way of looking at the U.S. by examining its educational and political systems. I believe those are the most important tools to looking at the U.S. Economics is very important, but that's a whole other show. And I do not profess to be a professional economist. So I don't have expertise in that area. I can talk in layman's terms. But when we look at what impacts people, and people may not be impacted always by politics, the political system personally, and maybe through political decisions, by legislation, by laws, by acts, so forth. But everyone, to a certain extent, is impacted by education. It's very important. So when we take a look at both of these systems, they both have an effect. They both are ways of looking at the United States, looking at the history of the United States, and also at the way the United States is currently functioning. It's also a way of looking at people in this country and why they believe the things they believe in, and why they think the way that they think, and what shapes them. And one of the most important aspects of shaping thought is education.
It certainly is, and this is a topic that we've talked about before in some detail in the Corbett Report, but from your research, what are some of the key factors that have taken place in shaping the American education system?
Right. I've been writing about it, reading about education for probably over 20 years now, and I'll make a small confession. When I was younger, I actually got training to be a substitute teacher here in Hawaii, which is where I'm currently living and where I was born and raised. When I was about 18, I was out of work at the time, and I decided I was going to try to be a substitute. Back then, this was 20 years ago or more, you didn't need a bachelor's degree to become a substitute teacher. You could be a high school graduate and do it. So in order to be a substitute, I took classes. You had to take classes, you had to take courses, and then you had to take a test. And that test was graded in front of you, and they let you know whether you passed or not, whether you were eligible. And it was, I think, the sort of limited training that I received there that got me interested in education, which is why I've read about it. Now, also it's the realization after coming out of high school. I went to public school. Did you go to public school yourself there, James, in Canada?
Yes, I did.
And what was your experience like in attending the public schools in Canada?
I have to say overall it was positive, but I think it might have been the luck of the draw in the schools that I was particularly at, because my brothers had a less positive experience and they attended a different school at a different time. So I think it may have been the luck of the draw, but I had an overall quite positive experience with quite helpful teachers.
Well, that sounds very good. I enjoyed high school myself. I didn't have a bad time in high school. For the most part, it was very productive and very enjoyable, and I had a good time. But it was after I came out of high school, either a year or less than a year, and even after I eventually went to college and got a degree, I eventually came to the conclusion that going to high school, going to public, going to school in general was a waste of time.
And how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, part of it was the kind of reading about education that I did that was engendered by learning about how to be a teacher, at least how to be a substitute teacher, in terms of my limited training. I think that got me interested in education. And once you start reading about the public educational systems, primarily in the United States, I'm not familiar with that much in Canada. I know a little about Japan. once you start reading about public education, and that is primarily what, when we talk about education in the U.S., we're talking about public education. You don't see articles written about private schools, right? You don't see articles that say, well, do private schools work or not? How do we reform private schools? No, that doesn't exist. Because private schools are assumed to work. Anywhere you go in the country, private schools are assumed to be doing their job. Public schools are the ones that are assumed to be not doing their job. They're assumed to be failures. If not failures, then struggling and near failure. So in order to gain, in my reading, I basically came to the conclusion that schooling itself is suspect, and that certainly the public schools are suspect. And my own view of the public schools this day, to this day, is that the public schools are, in the United States, are basically institutions that have been intentionally created and intentionally shaped in order to basically carry out an agenda.
Absolutely. Well, how is that process done, and what is the agenda that is being forwarded?
Well, basically, the agenda of public schooling in the United States, you know, we go back to the 19th century or so. It's basically to create workers. The belief is that when you go to school, if you go to a public school, that you are being trained, that you are being developed to be prepared, one, for college, two, for a career, three, to be a functioning citizen, you know, somebody who votes and somebody who takes care of the other obligations. This is not really the truth. The truth is that the overall function of American schooling and schooling in the United States has been to create workers for what used to be called industry. What I would call it now is the corporate slash company workforces. In other words, they're creating the office workers, the fast food workers, the retail workers of tomorrow. Those are just a few, you know, obviously industries or sectors of the economy, but that's what they're creating. They're not preparing people for college. They may believe they are, but they're not really. That's not the function of education in this country, you know. So it's interesting. When people talk about public schools, and I don't know if they talked about, I'm sure they complain about public schools in Canada, right?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, you know, everyone says, well, they need to be reformed, they need to be fixed, they need to be made better. And I know you're in Japan, and what is the general attitude in Japan to public schooling there?
Well, it's something of a different beast entirely, because, of course, there's the public schooling, but then there's also the cram schools that most students will attend after school, which I guess is a form of privatized education, but that's an actually a key component of a lot of children's education here.
Right. And in Japan, see, what's different about Japan, of course, Japan is more of a what I call a traditional society. It's a society that's basically, some people may criticize me for saying this, but I believe it's still a hierarchical society in many ways. Because if you look at the population in Japan, most people in Japan don't go on to colleges and universities. Only a percentage of the population do. That's where the importance of jukus, as you mentioned, cram schools are, right? Because if you want to send your kid to, what's the best school in Japan? I think it's the Mighty Todai, right? The University of Tokyo?
Yes, yep, absolutely. Yep.
If you want to send your kid to the Mighty Todai, the University of Tokyo, you want to make sure, you know, obviously that the kid's going to do well in school, but you're going to make sure he goes to a juku school. And you want to try to get him into the best jukus. And, of course, he's going to be studying at his school, and he's also going to be learning stuff at the juku school, so that when it comes time to enter university, enter colleges, get the test going, to basically apply for colleges, that he'll be able to get in. And I don't know what the population statistics are in Japan right now, but I believe, at least the last time I read it, it's maybe, what, 15-20% of the school-age graduate population goes on to
I don't know the percentages, but I find that hard to believe. I think the impression that I get is that actually quite a large number of people go on to university, but very few get into the prestigious big name universities that guarantee, you know, lifelong career.
Right. I mean, because it's kind of structured there, because you have Tokyo, University of Tokyo, you got Waseda, you got Keio, you got the other universities there. But when we, in getting back to the U.S., the function of public schools in the U.S. is not to prepare kids for college, not really. That's the function of private schools. That's why you send kids to private schools. You know, in the U.S., there are the elite private schools, and they're known as prep schools, right? Prep meaning preparatory. What are they preparing for? They're preparing for college. That is why you send kids to private schools. You're preparing them for college. You know, no one's under the, if you know anything about education or you have any brain in your head, you're not going to send a kid to a private school just so that he goes to a private school and that's it. You're going to send him to a private school because you want this kid to receive a, if not top flight education, then at least a superior education to the public schools. Because what is the real agenda of public schools? To create workers. So therefore, they don't need an outstanding education. President Woodrow Wilson gave a speech once, and he mentioned, and he was discussing education, and he knew something about education because he was a former president of Princeton University. And in the speech, he mentioned that we have to have a liberal education for one class of people. For another class, what would the education be? Or what would the education be for another class of people? Well, the other class or the other classes of people would receive an education that would fit them for being able to do difficult manual tasks. Right away, what do we see? We see that there's one form of education for one class of individuals or one segment of the population, and another form of education for another class or classes of classes, meaning comprising of a larger percentage of the population of the United States. So when I hear people talk about, well, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor, and we're becoming a two-class society, well, we've always been a two-class, really three-class society here in the United States. And the education system reflects that. It reflects the fact that children who go on to public schools for more than 100 years in this country are basically taught to be pliant, obedient, future workers. That's the function of U.S. education. But that's not what we're taught. That's not what people in this country, in the United States, are taught or really propagandized. We're taught, oh, it's for citizenship, or it's to prepare us for college. The facts aren't really there. I just cited the Wilson speech. Now, so, you know, that's what people need to realize. And again, it came from reading about education and also from my own instincts, you know, my own view of education when I was a kid. You know, it's amazing what people can pick up, what people can think about if they just allow themselves to kind of follow a certain chain of reasoning. It's very interesting.
It certainly is. I'm wondering, are you familiar with John Taylor Gatto and his writings?
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of his work. I was just reading some of his work today. And Gatto is very correct. He came to the same conclusions that I came to. Let me, for example, quote, for example, in backing up my thesis about the true agenda of American education in this country. This comes from a essay that John Taylor Gatto wrote called Against School. It was in Harper's Magazine in 2003. And he's quoting from H.L. Mencken, very well-known journalist of his time, in the April 1924 issue of American Mercury. And he mentions that the goals of education are basically to simply get as many individuals as possible to the safe level to breed and train a standardized citizenry, to put down dissent or originality. That is its aim in the United States, and that is its aim everywhere else. That's very important. That's very important. And in this essay, Gatto notes that mass schooling really is a phenomena that really gained steam from about 1905 to 1915. And he asked an interesting question. I think it's a question I think a lot of parents out there, I don't know, parents that, you know, listen to the interviews on this site or log on to this site, but it's something that parents should consider, and even their children, students should consider. And Gatto himself came to this conclusion. He was a school teacher that taught in the New York City public school system for about 30 years or more, a little over that. And he came to the conclusion, he said, what if there is no problem with our schools? What if they are the way they are, so expansively flying in the face of common sense and long experience in how children learn things, not because they are doing something wrong, but because they are doing something right? This is pay dirt. This is absolutely, absolutely the right train of thought. See, when people talk about the public schools failing, what they're talking about is the supposed real education that people are supposed to get. I would argue there are two real forms of education. There's the real agenda, which is to prepare kids to be workers of all sorts. Could be office workers, could be fast food workers. You could be working in a factory, you could be working in a store, you could be working in a restaurant, doesn't really matter. Preparing you for your workers. And there are the functional aspects of education. The physical plant, which is how a school, whether a school is run down or not, you know, in terms of its facilities. Curricula, basic curricula, like whether kids are taught to read and write effectively. You know, instructional quality or lack thereof, good teachers, bad teachers, all these other aspects. People look at those aspects, which are very functional aspects, and they say, well, this school isn't working. It's dysfunctional. And they're not wrong. They're right. But I would argue that public schools don't fail. In fact, they succeed beautifully. You know why? Because of the agenda I just outlined. Because they're preparing workers for what used to be called industry, but was now the corporate workplace. So I would argue public schools are not failures. They're success stories. They're just not success stories that we should celebrate.
Exactly. Well, they're succeeding at failing, basically. But so I guess one of the ways in which the education system can be used to mold more pliant and pliable workers is by taking children and really making their education something apart from their experience of the world around them, that they're actually distanced from the real world and forced into a regimented routine day where they concentrate on tasks which will, in all honesty, serve them very little in the coming years. And I think this is a point that Gatto makes in a lot of his work as well. So right. What can you say about the way that the system works to create pliable workers?
Very interesting. Well, basically what the public schools, how they get to implement their agendas by a twofold process. One is indoctrination, the other is socialization. Indoctrination is by the inherent structure of schools. We go to schools, we have classes, and those classes are run anywhere between 45 minutes to an hour, depending on what the school system is, and you move from one subject to the next. And of course, what this does is it provides the student what the student has to learn is the ability to manage the schedule, right? That has to do with schools, I mean, with work. Once you go to a job, you have a schedule. You have things to do, you have tasks to do. And it's the same with the classroom. When you go to school, you go to a class, you have homework, which you've got to turn in. There are classroom assignments. Some of them may be in-house assignments. Some of them homework. There are things you may do in class. You may be a monitor. You may be, you know, writing stuff on the board. You may be helping the teacher around, you know, the classroom. This is all to get, this is a way to mold and shape young people from children to adolescents. You get them to follow authority. That's one of the most important aspects of schooling, because that's the important thing. It's the subordination that has to be instilled in children and teenagers. They have to learn to be subordinate. They have to learn not to challenge authority. Because who is the authority in the classroom but the teacher? When I was undergoing the training that I mentioned before, they talked to me, they talked about classroom management. You ever heard that term used?
Absolutely, all the time.
Yeah. What you have to do as a teacher is to get control of your classroom. Now, some people may have heard that if you've seen movies about teachers, right? You know, you've got to get control of your classroom, Mr. Crabtree or whatever. You know, you can't let your students run wild. You know, you got to get them under control. That is what schools are about, control, right? You know, shut up. You know, as I don't know if you're a wrestling fan. I used to watch wrestling, you know, when I was younger. And I'm aware of some of these wrestlers that are out, you know, in the marketplace nowadays. You know, that movie star, The Rock. Well, when he was a wrestler, he had a line, right? And the line was, shut your mouth and know your role. And that's what children basically are told more than one way. Maybe not always directly, sometimes directly, but not always. Shut your mouth and know your role. Your role is to obey. Your role is to carry out what I tell you to carry out. So I remember when I was a substitute, you know, there's a lot I don't remember, but there's a lot. What I remember is classroom management. You have to get control of your classroom, especially if you're a substitute. Because when you're a substitute, kids think they can walk all over you, do whatever, because you're not around. You're some new person that's come up, and you're not the regular teacher. So they think they can do whatever they please and treat you like a doormat. But if you're a good substitute, you won't allow kids to do that. You will use classroom management to your advantage and gain control over your classroom. That is a matter of authority. The teacher is the authority, and of course in the school, the principals are the ultimate authority, right? So they have to, and the basic structure is no different. What would be a parallel institution in many respects, or institutions to the schools? The military and prisons. Think about it. Would you say that authority is important in both the military and in prisons?
Absolutely, that's the case.
Yeah. Well, that's what schools are. They're probably one of the three most important institutions in most societies. You have the schools, you have the prisons, and you have the military. And if you go through schools, you're basically prepared for basic fidelity to that authority. When you go into the military, it's all about authority. You know, you've got to listen to your drill instructor, you've got to listen to your lieutenant, your CO, you've got to listen to the other ranking officers. It's a system of hierarchy. It's a system of subordination, direct hierarchy. In prisons, you know, it's prisoners and guards and wardens. In fact, in many respects, schools are like prisons. That's how I felt when I was in school. And I didn't go to a so-called bad school. I didn't go to a school where there were tremendous fights and kids were carrying guns and knives. I didn't go to any school like that. You know, I went to schools that were generally, for the most part, fairly safe. Right? There weren't school shootings. There wasn't a lot of violence, that sort of thing. But still, there's that tie-in, the feel of prison, control. Schools have rules. You can't smoke. You can't drink. You can't do these things. Not that I did them anyway when I was in school. But it's that system of subordination and domination that's there. So that gets into indoctrination. You're being taught to submit to authority and that this is lawful authority. What teachers say go. And what teachers don't want you to do is to question their authority, right? They don't want students who are going to question what's being taught. Those are the rebels, the troublemakers, you know, the instigators, right? I don't agree with your take on the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Not that I would, you know, maybe it would come up in a classroom or not. You know, when you question authority, authority doesn't want to answer you back. So what students are taught in these schools, not to be rebels, you know? You do your homework, you show up, you respond when asked to respond, and that prepares you for the work world, right? Because when you go to work, what they want are people who aren't going to talk back. you do what I tell you to do. You know, you work at a fast food restaurant, then you take your orders, and, you know, you get the orders and give it to the people, and you do what I tell you to do. That's preparation for the work world. Not that people are necessarily trained in that regard, right? You know, people have different views. You know, not everyone's going to be a model employee, right? You know, that comes out of the school systems. It's not like you can come out of the school system and you're automatically a hard worker model employee. But that's the basic function. So they do that by the very structure of school, the very structure of classes, the very structure of having teachers as authority, principals as authority, by what students are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Then, as I mentioned before, there's socialization factor, because you can't just tell kids what to do and not allow them to have any release. So you have the social aspects, right? You have sports. That's part of the socialization factor. You have, it's also a way to instill authority, right? The coach is the authority. You do what he tells you to do, right? So you also have the sense of, you have events like proms, and you have banquets, and you have, you know, what is these? I'm trying to remember the term. Like, out of school, out of class events, right, or out of class activities. You're in the class play, or you're on the math team or chess team. These are all social aspects. They provide a valve so that students can, you know, showcase some of their talents, some of their skills. But it's within the context of the school, right? It's school approved or school, you know, sanctioned activities, or at least not school banned activities. So it's important to socialize children, teenagers, to school. So they'll find school fun, they'll enjoy it, they'll like it, and, you know, they won't be problems, or if they are problems, they'll be manageable problems. And that's how it works. Indoctrination, being taught basically also through the curricula is based on obedience. I mean, everything is conditioned around obedience, right? Obedience and subservience to authority. You're not really allowed to question not just the authority of the teachers or the principals, that's one thing, but the authority and the efficacy, you know, the truth, whether what you're being taught, say in history, for example, or even in literature, is accurate, fair, balanced, whether it's right. You know, if you ask questions, you know, there's a saying, I think it came from Japan, right, that the nail that sticks up gets hammered.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Yeah, they don't want you to be the nail that sticks up, because they'll have to hammer you and keep hammering at you until you're down in that piece of wood. So that's very important, indoctrination and socialization.
Absolutely, and you talk about the ways in which indoctrination works at a systemic level, that this structure of the school day and everything serves to reinforce that hierarchy. But I guess there's also the sense of indoctrination in terms of the content of what children are learning, or more specifically not learning, right, or not allowed to think about.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole other story. I mean, just let's look at history, right? I mean, all you need to do is go on the Corbett Report and look at some of the historical articles, the articles that mention history, and compare it to what you were taught in school. I mean, I remember when I got to college and took some of these history classes. I remember, it's been, I don't know how long since I've been to college, but I remember when the students came into the computer room at the library, and he said, you know what, the history that I was taught in high school was BS compared to what I'm learning now. We weren't taught the real stuff. I said, yeah, you're right. I don't disagree with you. You're absolutely correct. You find that out when you go to college. Right, if people go to college, or even if they do learn, you know, even if they start learning on their own, the very aspect of textbooks, I mean, in the U.S. is that's always a controversial issue, because you have people like the Gablers in Texas, you have various groups that will, you know, they will go through a textbook, a new textbook, with a tooth and comb to find anything left-wing about it. And some groups will go through a tooth and comb to find anything right-wing about it. So the so-called culture wars, that cultural component of it, you know, that plays a kind of role. But the larger role has nothing to do with Republican and conservative. It has nothing to do with Democrat and Republican. It has to do with the overall agenda of public schools. As I mentioned before, it's to create workers for the corporate/company workforce. And they do this through indoctrination and socialization. That's what's important. And, you know, again, in the teaching of subjects, the structure of the school and the teaching of subjects, what you're doing is you're shaping a reality for the students. You know, what we want are students that aren't going to question the wisdom or the facts or the information that's been handed down to them. That's getting a little harder probably with internet. I didn't have the internet when I was going to school. But I assume that teachers are probably tearing their hair out of their head when you have kids who'll say, look, I went on the Corbett Report and I read this article, and that's not the same as what you're teaching me. I mean, it must drive some of these teachers nuts.
I certainly hope it is, and I certainly hope that is going on. And I know there are some, we've talked to some young people who are still in high school, and we've had them on the program before and talked to some people who are going through that process, and it is extremely difficult for them to bring in alternative information into the school system, as one might well expect. And I don't know if you're familiar, have you heard of the Rees Commission?
The Rees Commission?
Yes.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
I believe it was a Senate special committee that was set up in the 1950s to investigate the large charitable foundations that were set up by the robber barons as tax-exempt charitable foundations, which they could pour their personal wealth into tax-free. And it was set up in the 1950s to investigate the activities of these foundations. And there was a researcher for that committee called Norman Dodd, who did an interview in 1982 with G. Edward Griffin, which is still widely available online and is absolutely essential viewing for anyone who's interested in this subject, because he goes into how he was, as part of the commission, able to gain access to the original meeting minutes of the board members of the Carnegie Foundation, and going back to 1908, I believe. And basically, from the meeting minutes of the Carnegie Foundation itself, they were able to demonstrate that, in fact, the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefellers, and other large charitable foundations had, in effect, set up a system of control over education at the university level, where I believe the Carnegies were in charge of the domestic American scholars, and Rockefellers and other foundations were in charge of international scholarship. So you have the Rhodes Scholars and that type of thing. But basically, they were using their influence to ensure that only professors who would write a certain version of American history would be put in positions to shape the American history curriculum in the school system. So again, it goes right back to the, again, the large, powerful interests that have something to gain by, of course, keeping people in the dark.
Well, that's why when you look at the history of public education in this country, I always say, if I'm talking to a parent, if people actually read the history of education in this country, they would never send their kids to public schools. They wouldn't. It's a history of educators and of the wealthy elite getting together and creating an education system that, as I mentioned in the speech of Woodrow Wilson earlier, that will provide one form of education for one class of people and another form of education for a larger class or for larger classes of the population of the United States. And this is what is happening, or this is what has happened with education in this country. And when you read about education, the history of education in the U.S., you hear about people like Horace Mann, you know. Well, what, you know, Gatto himself wrote a book called the Underground History of Education. And I read an essay, you know, dealing with that. And it's fascinating because you deal with educators. And this has accrued from decade over decade over decade. People like Horace Mann, who was Commissioner of Education in Massachusetts, who wanted to, of course, set up schools. And, of course, he had gone to Europe. He had gone to places, you know, like Prussia, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Because Gatto himself notes in his essays and in his books that Prussia was one of the major models for education in the United States. What do we see with Prussia? Classes. So age-separated classes, right? So we have, great, in this country we have three basic, we have a basic structure of education. When you think about it, education is kind of, you know, kind of like literature in a sense. It's kind of like a film when you think about it. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? Well, actually, when I speak about education, let's define some further terms so we can be even more specific. By an education, I mean a body of knowledge that has been created by certain individuals or by individuals and approved of by an authority. That is an education. Learning, however, is the ability to access information or knowledge, and it's, this ability can vary in various individuals, and that lasts a lifetime. In other words, we never stop learning. You will never stop learning. I will never stop learning, because that is an inherent ability within all human beings, is to learn. However, we can stop being educated in the formal sense of an education. You have an education, and when it comes to public schools, at least in terms of primary and then secondary schooling, you have the elementary schools, the middle schools, and the high schools. Again, beginning, middle, end, right? So, there are people that we can see in American history and through other forms of history that are uneducated. Ben Franklin was an uneducated man. He didn't go to college. George Washington was an uneducated man to a certain extent. Even someone like Harry Truman, who was the last president not to have a college degree, might be considered uneducated in a formal collegiate sense. And here's a man with a high school education, and he was president, wound up president of the United States. Nowadays, that would never happen. Someone like Barack Obama has degrees from Columbia University and Harvard Law School. He's an educated man, supposedly. But we get back to the idea of an education. An education is a formal body of knowledge that has been created by someone. The curricula, the ways of teaching, the ways of harnessing and transmitting this education were created by individuals, and they were approved of by some formal authority. So when we have state education, we have the schools, it's approved of by a state body of education or a district department of education. So that corresponds, or that is not the same as learning as we know it. So when we get into education, again, we know what the agenda is, as I just mentioned. And I think it's very important to note that it's interesting to see individuals in the history of this country who we would not consider educated, but are still learned individuals, people who possess a high degree of learning. And I think part of that, when we talk about learning and we talk about education, is that education will always vary, but our ability to learn might grow over time, right? Now, when I talk about the varying of education, I think it's important to look at high schools in this country, right? High school, the role of high school is playing, right? Like in Canada, I believe, do most people go to high school and graduate from high school?
Yes, I'd say the majority.
Right. Now, in the United States, at one time, that wasn't the case. See, high school has become an important kind of transition point when we talk about education. See, most people go to high school and they graduate from high school. That wasn't always the case, right? Let's look back 100 years ago in 1909. If you look back in 1909, I can argue that I doubt that 50% of the population of this country, and by population I mean, say, 17, 18-year-old population, I doubt most of those people had a high school diploma. Now, we would say, well, that's a shame because those people aren't educated. But the fact of the matter was that high school wasn't deemed as important. Now, let me just quote here from an essay. It's from the New Press Education Reader, and it's written by an individual called Judith Grenier. It's called The Making of a Revolution. To give some historical perspective on high school itself, right? Now, in 1820, Ms. Rainey says, 70% of American workers were farmers or farm laborers. In other words, you either owned a farm and worked on it, or you worked for a farmer. This was in 1820. Now, about 50 years later, that number decreased. It was about 50% of people working on farms. 10% were white-collar jobs, right? Clerks and so forth. And other people worked in factories. It says here, mines, railroads, industries. By 1960, that was less than 10% of people on farms. 40% were doing white-collar jobs. Today, it's less than 3%, right? Now, let's take a look. So that was the sort of employment, because, you know, as I mentioned before, what education does is it prepares people for basically the work, well, to be workers. It doesn't always prepare them well for the work world. That's the controversial part. But it prepares them to be workers. So what Ms. Rainey notes is that in 1870, the vast majority of America labored in factories and on farms. About 80,000 teenagers, they were called adolescents probably back then, children, but I would call them teenagers. 80,000 teenagers were in about 500 high schools or high school academies, right? And most of these schools were probably private, and they were in the Northeast, right, the eastern states. In that same year, 16,000 students got high school diplomas. Now, this constituted 2% of the population of 17 years. 2%. So 16,000 kids out of 80,000 adolescents, right, got high school diplomas. That was a graduating class, I guess, that year across the country. And she notes something very interesting. She notes that high school just 120 years ago was not an end in itself, but academic preparation for college and a professional life. So most people didn't go to high school, right? And certainly in 1870, most people did not go to high school. You know, if you're fortunate, you received probably elementary, some middle schooling, and then you went on to work on a farm, maybe in an office somewhere, depending on where you lived. Now, let's fast forward to 1910. We've got 1.1 million Americans enrolled in high schools. Of this number, about 90% are in about 10,000 public schools. So more schools have been built, more people are in these schools. Of this, about 15% enrolled about through the ages of 14 to 70. So 15% of 14 to 70-year-olds enrolled. And what's interesting is these people that were going to high school weren't going to prepare for college. They were going just to get an education. It was a sort of a means unto itself. So they go there, and then they go into the work world. What's interesting also is the change in education, or at least in regards to high school. What happened is high school began to become more and more of a way station, or was considered an important enough way station, for adolescents and adolescent teenagers to go in. After about World War I, there were compulsory school attendance laws. So kids couldn't get away with not going to school. You know, they'd say, you know, you got to go to school or there'll be legal ramifications. So you have greater enrollments in many of these schools. But again, we look at 1910, 85% of young people who weren't in high school in 1910, they had to work. 85% included various immigrants. So what we see historically is a change in high schools, right? For example, look at high school enrollment between about 1900 and 1920, explosion of enrollments. You also see a historical shift throughout the 1930s, because you have less children working, right? Because it used to be children were, you know, labor laws for children. So you had children working. When, with the compulsory school attendance laws and the laws against child labor, you put more kids in school and thus more teenagers in high schools. So you have greater prosperity level. So, you know, you have more kids going to high school. And eventually it gets to the point where college is considered important, right? So it's interesting looking at high school in and of itself. You know, years ago, high school was not considered important. Now it's considered important. You don't graduate from high school, people kind of look down on you, right?
And it's very difficult to find a job without a high school diploma.
Yeah, well, the economy has changed too. It's become a more credentialed economy. It's a more credentialed economy where, you know, say post-World War II America, you know, it's possible to get a job with a high school diploma or less. You can work in a factory, you can make more than $10 an hour, make $15, $20 an hour or so. And, you know, raise a family, you know, provide fairly well for a wife and kids. That's not feasible today, even though the educational standards supposedly are raised, more people graduating high school, certainly in 2009 than they did in 1909, more people in college, but wages have declined since about the 70s, and the jobs that have risen in the past, say, 10, 15 years or so, are either temp jobs or your retail jobs. More chances to work at Walmart than there are to work at,
GM.
Yeah. Right. Oh, that's a whole other story.
Exactly.
That's a whole other story with the auto industry. Again, the auto industry was one of those places where people could get a good salary.
Exactly.
You know, could support a family.
And that's was the manufacturing base that made America what it was. But, of course, the manufacturing economy has been displaced by the service economy and temporary positions. So,
right.
Of course, that's it's a different topic, but it's also related, I guess, to the way that the economy has changed,
right,
and how that's affected,
right,
the education system and vice versa. But I guess...
It has affected the education system only in that it's modified it. See, what I believe is happening now, or what's happened in the past, say, 20 years or more, is there's more of an emphasis on college. This is because of the post-war years, right? College became more of a reality for more people. Partly this was because of what happened after World War II. You had the GI Bill, and this allowed returning veterans to, you know, apply for college and universities to get X amount of money for tuition and also for housing and so forth and other expenses. And they could attend school and get out and maybe get a professional job somewhere, or at least a managerial job, or some job where they'd be able to earn a decent salary. You know, that was a revolution in and of itself. And, of course, education had something to do with that. Perhaps not high, you know, primary and secondary education, per se, but it has to do with that shift. The idea that, yes, more people can go to colleges and universities. But what I believe has happened is there has been a shift only in the sense of what we see in regards to, say, suburban, the better public schools and the not-so-great urban schools or rural schools, right? The suburban schools and the private schools prepare students for college. Most public schools prepare students to be workers. Again, this conforms with what I mentioned about Woodrow Wilson. We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class to be fitted for difficult manual tasks, right? Vocational work, retail work, restaurant work, whatever kind of work, factory work, whatever kind of work. That's very important. So that's why I say that the public schools are more successful than people think. Their true agenda is to produce, you know, cogs. You know, I wouldn't even say cogs in the wheel, because if you're a part of a wheel, then at least the wheel will go somewhere. It'll transport somewhere if it's part of a bus or a car. They're more like bricks in the wall. The writer who wrote I forget who wrote the song for, I think it was for Pink Floyd's movie The Wall. The song goes, you know, we don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. Whoever wrote that knew what he was doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
He knew from experience. It's a very good song. And if you get the chance, I forget the title of it. If you get the chance to see it, or see The Wall, for example, I think there's a sequence that has the song in it, you know, that deals with the song. But,
I'm thinking the song is called The Wall, but I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, you may be right. It's been a year since I've listened to it.
Yeah.
I remember the lyrics, but...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's quite a famous song. Well, I guess this type of conversation would usually go in the direction of, well, how do we fix this problem with the education system? But I guess if the problem is the system itself, then the question becomes, how do we change this system?
Well, that's the hard part. That's the hard part. My belief is that you can't, reform doesn't mean anything. See, because, again, there are two dual levels to this. There's the functional level of schools, and then there's the true agenda of schooling. What people are usually up in arms against is the functional levels of schools. As I mentioned before, the physical plant, the level of teaching, what's in the curricula, that's the aspect. And you can correct that. I mean, you could bring in nice teachers, you can possibly tear down a school if you want or build new facilities. You could do those things if you wanted to. That doesn't change the true nature and agenda of schooling. That's the problem. I mean, it's not that those problems aren't important. They're highly important. They're very important. But the real agenda is what is behind not just what is wrong with my particular school or what's wrong with these particular schools, but with the whole concept of schools. Why do parents decide to homeschool their children? That's seen by some as weird and strange and creepy and what have you. But as Gatto himself has said, John Taylor Gatto has said, in a sense, when you send your kids to school, it's adoption. You're basically saying, as a parent, I'm not fit to teach my children. This teacher is, or this principal is. I'm not fit. The natural teachers of children, whether they're good teachers or bad, whether they're horrible parents or great parents, are parents. They're the teachers of children. But we've created this professional class we call teachers, and we've told them we provided them with curricula and lesson plans and structure and all of this, and this is what we want you to teach to these children. We've created a professional class called teachers, which are certified and licensed by the state or by state bodies. We've created that in this society. What's interesting to me is what happened before there were schools. How did individuals like Ben Franklin develop into bright, literate individuals if they weren't schooled? How is it that someone like Ted Kennedy, who's just passed, according to Gatto, I believe he came out with a press release, this was years ago, that said that 85%, well, I think it was 85 or 98% of the population of Massachusetts prior to schools were literate. How is that possible? How could people be literate, know how to read, know how to write, if there are no schools? You begin to question the whole structure of schools, and that's very dangerous. What I'm saying right now is dangerous. It's dangerous. To say that schools are the problem is dangerous. And, you know, who am I? I'm just a writer. I'm not a professional educator. I'm not a principal. Who am I to say this? Well, I'm somebody who's been to schools, and I'm somebody who received a certain amount of training, a little amount of training, but a certain amount of training, you know, as a teacher. I never became a teacher, but I learned it. So that got me thinking, you know. You can see that there are systems of domination and subordination at work in the school systems. And this is what schooling is about. To change that, we have to get rid of schools. And that's so radical a concept that even I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, it's simply not going to happen. I mean, if we really cared about education in this country, we'd get rid of every public school in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, quite a radical thought, but one that
it's absolutely radical.
One that we inevitably arrive at once you start to realize the true agenda behind the education system itself.
Right.
Well, Albert Lanier, another fascinating conversation, but we're going to have to leave it here. So if people are more interested in following you and your work, how can they get in touch with you or read your work online?
Well, if you have any comments, questions, or items or agendas you want to bring up, you can reach me at the website at my email address, which is ajlanier01@msn.com. That's ajlanier01@msn.com, and I'll try to answer emails if they're sent to me. You can also check out some of my other interviews that I've done, not just with the Corbett Report, but also with other websites like Media Monarchy and TV News Lies and so forth. that I've done, and I encourage people to do that. Always support the other sites that are out there, including this one. Outside of that, I don't have a website. I admit I'm not a self-promoter. I'm not somebody who's out there to sell stuff. You know, I'm just a writer and a journalist. I guess I'm not a I'm afraid that I'm a terrible corporate shill, James. I'm not funded by the Ford Foundation or Carnegie Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation or multi-million dollar organizations or, you know, I'm just not, you know, I'm not in that ballpark. So,
well, join the club. All right. Well, Albert Lanier, it was good talking with you again today, and take care, and I hope to talk to you again in the future.
All right. See you later.